All right, thank you for those of you who stayed. As I promised this morning, this is where you get the real help. So those who bailed, they will forever wish they had been here. So, but you endured. I did have one criticism of the morning. Tom and Nancy said, "Please don't look down on us." She wrote me a little note. It's a picture of Tom, 5'1", Nancy, 4'8". So, trust me, I don't. That was great. I appreciate that. That made me laugh. All right, this afternoon, this session, we're going to talk about the rubber meets the road when it comes to we learn what God's called us to do, to prepare ourselves to give answers to those who challenge our faith. We learned about what's going on in the heart and mind of every unbeliever. Now we're going to look at a tactic or a methodology for when we start a conversation with unbelievers, where does it go? And some apologetic methods lay out a plan. Every single person, you approach them this way. A good example is The Way of the Master with Kirk Cameron. It's a good resource, but I think it's too formulaic. With every person you meet, you start with the Ten Commandments, and you try to show them that they're guilty. And that may work with some people, but I think the Bible doesn't give us a specific canned approach for a reason, is that if we take the time to get to know unbelievers, ask questions about what they believe, where the conversation can go can be any number of ways. Whereas if I follow a pre-prepared approach, I come across as a salesman. And right out of college, I sold cars for a while, and I hated it because we had this preset speech that we gave. We had methods of getting people to buy the car that day, and it turned me off so much. I only lasted about 3 months, and I said, I can't do this. And if we come across as salespeople or strong-arm pressure type of presentation, it's not going to go well. We want to rather reveal, open up the eyes of the unbeliever to the failure of their belief to address the real issues of life, and then show them Christ. Show them how the Christian gospel gives the answers. So let's take a look at 2 Corinthians 10. God gives us a brief description of a tactic here, or an understanding of what we are called to do. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. And Paul uses the metaphor of pulling down strongholds. So we finished the last hour talking about how an unbeliever's belief system forms his worldview. It's how he explains who he is, why he's here, where he came from, what's wrong with the world, how to get it right. Everyone has a basic belief system like that. And then in this passage, Paul talks about our tactic then is, as we present Christ, is to seek to pull down the stronghold in which they trust. And so I found this picture. It's a good example of a person's belief system, that throughout their lives they're building up their stronghold that protects and defends what they believe, and when we encounter them, sometimes we encounter difficult opposition. If we tried to take this castle, there'd be a number of things standing in the way. But if we would see our goal is simply one by one, as much as we're allowed, to pull down the bricks that make up their stronghold. And sometimes in an engagement with an unbeliever, the whole thing collapses. Like the guy in the coffee shop who stood up and said, I don't even know what I believe anymore. Other times, in your conversations with someone, you just remove one brick of their unbelief. And a little more of the light of the gospel shines through. And we have to be patient with God, because there might be other people pulling down bricks somewhere else, or it might take 20 years for them to finally let their belief system collapse. So 2 Corinthians chapter 10, let's beginning in verse 3. Paul says, "For though we walk in the flesh," that is, we're physical people, "we are not waging war according to the flesh." We don't take up arms in the battle of the Christian faith or for the truth. "For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to obey Christ." And then in the church, being ready to punish every disobedience when your obedience is complete. So Paul gives us this metaphor of tearing down, not the other person. It's very important. We're not tearing the other person down, but we're seeking, as we ask them about what they believe, to show them inconsistency, show where they're irrational, and in doing that, it pulls down their stronghold of unbelief. So let's take a look at a few things here. Some metaphors help. We want to pull the rug out from underneath their feet. I know this is not in your notes, but just a way to envision it. If someone is going to attack me, I can either try to defend myself directly, or I can just pull the rug out from under their feet, like happens in comedy movies, and they fall down because they have nothing to stand on. And so this is why before I try to answer their objections, I'm going to question their objections. So as we said in the first hour, prove God exists to me. So here's the challenge. I can try to present all these proofs, and Christians through the centuries have tried. Anselm in the 12th century, Aquinas in the 14th century tried to come up with these arguments for the existence of God, proofs for the existence of God. I never use those. Never. Because unless the person is philosophically trained, they're just going to go right over their head. And there have been good responses written through the years against them. So our natural reaction when an objection comes is to hit it head on. We throw all our evidence on there, and then they just come up with another objection. And we just keep doing this. And then we wonder why we're not getting anywhere. So before I ever give any answers to their objections, I'm going to question their objection. So I have the idea of pulling the rug out from underneath their feet. Or disarming unbelievers in the battle of beliefs. I have a friend who's into, I think it's judo. And he says, judo is a kind of martial arts where you don't strike, but rather use your enemy's or your opponent's motion against him. So if he comes at you swinging, you actually pull him toward you. So rather than object to everything they say, I'm going to question their objection. When they get it right, like there's something not right in the world, I totally agree. As a Christian, I completely agree. We ought to be outraged at injustice. We ought to care for the people that can't care for themselves. I completely agree. But how does that work in your worldview? If they have an atheistic evolutionary worldview, to say, hey, that's just the way natural selection works. Why are you outraged about it? I agree with you, but that only makes sense in a Christian worldview. So I use their very argument for evil and suffering, as we'll look at next hour, against them and show them that their own worldview can't answer that. So let's begin with prayer, and then we will jump in. Father, we're thankful for what you've given us in Scripture, all the direction and guidance. And right now, our bodies are coursing with sugar, and it's early afternoon almost, and I pray that you'd help us to be able to stay awake and pay attention, that we might learn, and that we might even this week put into practice what we learn in this hour. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so I want you to notice, first of all, what Paul is saying in this passage is that we need to challenge the authority of the unbeliever's belief system. I want to challenge the authority. That is, when someone comes to me and says, Mark, don't you know science has disproved God? I need to then challenge their whatever their view of science is. Or if they say something like, reasonable people don't believe in invisible gods anymore. I want to find out, what are they trusting? Are they trusting in a college professor that showed them that? Are they trusting in a YouTube video that they watched? Because these days, a lot of arguments from God don't really come from careful thinking. It comes from someone who makes a really good emotional point on a YouTube video. So I want to challenge that, and we'll see in just a moment how to do that. So to destroy a stronghold is to reveal the weakness of the authority in which the unbeliever trusts. I want to expose what they're trusting in and then show how it fails when tested. Many of you saw the tragedy that happened down in Florida a couple days ago, where a bridge collapsed and killed, was it six people? At least six people, if not more. In other words, you had people building that bridge, engineers that designed it, that said, this is safe, and yet on its own, it collapsed and killed people. In other words, it could not stand the test of time. So what I want to do is, as I'm talking to an unbeliever, figure out what they're trusting. Are they trusting in their own wisdom? Are they trusting in some religious authority? Someone, you know, some college professor, Stephen Hawking, you know, whatever it might be. Who are they trusting in? I want to show how when we examine that authority, it cannot give the answers to the pressing questions of our world. So I want to ask questions that force the person to reveal the foundations for their beliefs. And this is one of those revolutionary things that I learned as I began to study apologetics, like, oh, this is so different. Because again, I was always taught to give that gospel burp, to get it all out, do a monologue, and hopefully that person was somehow magically ready to be saved, and they would say, oh yes, I need that message right now, I need Jesus. That did happen once or twice, but 99% of the time that doesn't happen. So what I need to do then is I need to learn to ask questions, and questions are powerful. Questions are subversive, aren't they? They cause us to think about things we wouldn't otherwise think. So teenage boys, what's more persuasive? Your mom saying, Jimmy, I told you to take out the trash, or, you know, put your dishes in the sink. You know, you've heard that 1,000 times, right? You just kind of tune that out, yeah. But what's more persuasive is if you get up to leave dinner and your mom says, you going to leave that dish right there? See, it's posed as a question, forces you to think about it, and you've got to ask the you got to answer the question, yes, I'm going to leave this dish here and make my mom do it, or I'm going to put the dish in the sink myself. Because questions force us to think. So what I want to do when I encounter an unbeliever, I'm not even going to talk about Jesus right away. shouldn't you just say it right away? Well, you know what? When Jesus talked with Nicodemus and he talked with the woman at the well, he led them into a discussion. He asked them questions and directed the conversation so that it naturally flowed into a spiritual discussion. So here are some of the questions that I often ask when I'm in conversation with an unbeliever and the subject turns to spiritual things or their heart belief or their worldview. Now, these have been honed over many years. They're trademarked, so please, if you ask one of these questions, make sure you properly cite me, okay? Because they're really profound, and you have to be prepared. Make sure you have a fresh pen, because it's going to blow you away, okay? No, just kidding. These are questions, very normal questions. So when I'm talking to someone, and they say they believe something, or they ask me why I believe, or they throw a challenge, I'll ask questions like, what do you mean by that? I know, mind blown, right? Wow, that's so profound. No, it's not profound at all. That's the point. When someone says, well, I could never believe in a God that just, capriciously strikes people down. Before I give any answer, I'm going to ask a question. What do you mean by that? And sometimes I will ask questions for 15 minutes before I ever begin to give an answer, because many times people will throw accusations out there that they know are not true. They'll bluff. They will say things that they heard somewhere else. They don't even know if they're true or not. I was on a plane one time with a guy, and we got talking about various things, and he asked me what I did, and I was a seminary professor at the time, and he goes, oh, I really like Jesus. You know, Jesus was a good guy, and except for that one time he sinned, he really lived a really noble life. It's like, what was that? He goes, you know that one time Jesus sinned? I said, what do you mean by that? I just asked this question. Well, I don't know. Didn't he sin at one time? I said, no, I know the Bible pretty well, and I don't recall any time he sinned. He's like, huh. Well, what about that time that his mother asked him to turn water into wine, and he kind of like, didn't he say something rude to her? And I said, well, he did rebuke her sharply and said, now's not the time for me to reveal my power. You can't force that to happen. He goes, so he didn't sin then? I said, no, he didn't sin. It's like, oh, I'm really glad you cleared that up. I thought Jesus sinned. So simply by asking, what do you mean by that, it led to some clarity. And that conversation took a really sharp turn after that. He had told me he was in the army, and all of a sudden he said, you know, when I was in Iraq, we did some really bad things. I didn't say anything. I just sat there. We're on a plane. We're landing in Philly in about 20 minutes. He said, I was part of a guard post protecting a forward operating base And we had orders to shoot men at 100 yards if they would not stop coming toward us because there were suicide bombings in the area. He said we had orders to shoot women at 75 yards. And you know what comes next. And he said, how could God ever forgive me for what I did over there? And I don't think when he got on the plane, he intended to tell the person sitting next to him that kind of thing. But because I was able to ask a question, correct him on some of his misunderstanding, and show an interest in his life, it suddenly led to the point where he wanted to know, what do I do with this guilt I have? And that's what we have to remember too, is the Holy Spirit, as we're having the conversation, stepping out on faith, even though we're afraid, we're not sure what to say, the Holy Spirit is the one that's working. And sometimes what I say has almost no bearing whatsoever on where the conversation goes, because the Spirit's working in them. And we've got to remember that. So by asking questions, it helps to answer some of the things that they're even asking of us. Here's another question. Why do you believe that? And these are all variations on a theme. There's nothing unique about any of them. But when someone says something like, well, I think Christianity is just like all other religions. I think world religions are the same. My natural tendency is to say, no, they're not. And then they could say, yes, they are. And I could say, no, they're not. Yes, they are. That's not productive, is it? So when you don't know what to say, ask a question. That's the general rule of apologetics. When someone says something and you think, I don't know what to say, ask a question. A lot of times if someone says something or they believe in something, I'll often say, well, I don't know much about that. Tell me more about that. Even if I know a little bit, I know I don't know as much as they do. And don't we love to talk about ourselves? When someone says, tell me about yourself, do you got 2 hours? You know, we're ready to talk. Ryan and I, this summer, we did a study abroad group at Lancaster Bible College. We did a study abroad class at Oxford University for 3 weeks this summer. Got to go all the places where C.S. Lewis was and saw different sites. And we took an overnight trip to Scotland and stayed in a hostel, which is basically a college dorm for anybody passing through. And we found a room. It was Ryan, my nephew, and I. We stayed in the room, and the other guy staying in the room was a Sikh from India. If you know anything about Sikhism, they wear turbans, often mistaken for Muslims, but they have a religion that is more like Christianity in the sense that they believe in a single God and He's revealed Himself. But I didn't remember too much about Sikhism from my time teaching world religion, so. When he came back to the room that night, I just asked questions. And I said, tell me more about your religion. I know a little bit about it. And it opened up the door for us to share Christ with him. But the key is simply to ask questions. Even if someone says, I believe this, and you grew up in that, ask questions. Because sometimes they don't believe everything about that religious faith. And you want to know exactly where they are, what they're trusting in. So ask these type of questions. Here's a few more. How do you know that? How do you know that? Well, Christianity, oh, yeah, I've seen this status before. You're more likely to be killed by an American, white nationalist or terrorist than you are by a foreign terrorist. How do you know that? It's not true, but, by asking that question, I force people to reveal their sources. Or I think Christianity is the worst scourge that's ever happened. Some of the new atheists like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens when he was alive, said basically religion and especially Christianity are dangerous to the world. If someone says that, I'm going to ask them this question. How do you know that? Where do you get that from? What do you base that on? Here's another one. You're like, Mark, these kind of sound like the same question over and over. They really are. But what I'm doing is I'm pushing back on their objection, forcing them to justify the things that they're saying, because that's what they're doing of me. And I want to establish, first of all, that what they believe is contradictory and it's irrational. So when I present the Christian faith, they can see the contrast between those two. I believe this. This person has shown me that it contradicts itself. I've said things that I think, oh, that doesn't make sense. And then they've presented Christ in all his glory with all the wisdom of God, and that makes more sense. And that's my goal in every encounter, is to show them the contrast between the wisdom and glory and truth of the Christian faith focusing on Jesus and their worldview, which when examined falls apart because it's full of contradictions. Here's a few more questions. How have you come to that conclusion? Where did you get that idea? Well, Christianity is, you know, just a copy of the ancient Egyptian religion of Osiris and Horus. And, you know, there's a movie out called Zeitgeist, the movie. And it tries to compare Christianity with this ancient Egyptian religion when they say everything in Christianity is a copy of this Egyptian religion. It's simply not true. So when I asked them, where did you get that idea? Well, I got it from this video. Well, there's a lot of resources which show that video is totally bogus and that they're not consistent with what they found in the Egyptian religion. Who said that? Again, these are all just repetitions of the same question, forcing people to justify what their criticisms against Christianity. Is that source reliable? Well, I went on this blog and this person said, okay, is that a reliable source? Do we believe everything on the internet? Well, yes, because the internet said that they're not allowed to print lies on the internet. Well, hopefully we can see beyond that. Can you give me an example of that? It's another good one. So basically the point is whenever someone raises an objection against a Christian faith, before I give my answer, I want to ask questions, show them that what they're saying is a contradiction. And I know this, if they believe something that's not the Christian faith, it is a contradiction. You cannot escape that fact. And in my own personal life, just going on kind of a, not really a spiritual journey, but pursuing in my academic career, trying to find answers to that. During one of my master's degrees, I went to Harvard for a semester and studied New Testament Greek manuscripts. And the professor was an atheist, world-renowned expert on the New Testament, didn't believe anything of it. Spent his whole life studying the New Testament, didn't believe it at all. And everyone else in the class, unbelievers, and yet through that class, it became very clear that the New Testament documents are perfectly reliable. No one wanted to admit that, but it became obvious as we studied the actual manuscripts of the early New Testament. And later in my doctoral program, spent a year at Villanova studying philosophy, German philosophy, and coming to realize philosophy has no arguments against the Christian faith. Philosophy itself is in shambles as a discipline, where philosophers admit no one agrees on anything. So when people say philosophy has all the answers, it's laughable. They don't even agree with one another. And so by asking questions, I'm exposing these things and showing that if you don't believe in Christ, then your belief system contradicts itself at some point. What are some of the authorities unbelievers typically rely on? First of all, science. And most people who use science as an objection to God misuse science. They want to say only what can be observed is fact. True scientists, some of you here are scientists. You work in some scientific field as an engineer or biologist or something in science, and most churches I speak at have scientists in them who know that science doesn't work that way. Science doesn't disprove God. In one of my classes at Lancaster Bible College, we teach about that science is a gift from God to discover a world. But it can't handle questions outside the natural world. And there's all kinds of truth that we accept that is not in the natural world. Here's an advertising campaign that was in England a couple years ago. It was put on buses. It says, there's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. And what's one of the problematic words in that statement? Probably, that's right. But there's another one too. It's the word enjoy. Is that all life is enjoyment? There's no place for sorrow or grief or trouble or difficulty. In other words, if there is no God, that's great for times when you're enjoying life because there's no limitations, you can do what you want. But what do you do when someone's dying? What does your atheism do for you then? I asked my skeptic friend, I said, let me ask you a question. You have friends who are atheists who die? Yep. So what comfort do you give at the end of their lives? He goes, oh, there's no comfort. The only comfort is to know that eventually you'll be out of this pain and then you'll cease to exist. Like, wow, you must be great at a hospital bed. I'd really rather not have you as a chaplain. In other words, atheism works great, in a sense, when life is going good. But you have no answers for when things go wrong. And you have no way to object to brokenness in the world, because if natural selection runs the world is exactly the way it's supposed to be. But intuitively, people, even people that believe that, grieve over suffering. They're outraged over injustice. But if what they believe is true, they have no business being those things or feeling those things. Here's Katharine Hepburn, a quote, "I'm an atheist and that's it. I believe there's nothing we can know except that we should be kind to each other and do what we can for other people." So taking those questions I gave you, what question would you want to ask Katharine Hepburn? What does she assume in that statement? Yeah, why? If there is no God, then kindness is one option. But if, you know, if I'm an aggressive, cruel person, I hope you believe this because you'll be just easier to take advantage of. But there's no compelling reason apart from God to be kind. You might say, well, we'll all live together in a nicer way. Well, society will work better. Yeah, that's one way. But again, if I have the resources or the physical strength, I can make society work my way too. There's no compelling reason for me to be kind. Notice she also says there's one thing we can know. Really? How do you know that one thing, Katharine Hepburn? And why is there only one thing that we can know? And why is it this thing? In other words, when you begin to examine this statement, you realize it's assuming so much that it cannot prove. Here's another one. You could be good without God. What question would you want to ask someone who would say something like that? What is good? Who defines good? The abortion doctor thinks he's doing good because he's removing a problem from a woman's life. But we would say, no, that's not good. People that want to involuntarily end the life of older people who become useless to society, they think they're doing good. In my ethics class at LBC, I teach on eugenics and the growing desire to rid society of people who don't contribute. So as you know, in Iceland, they've reduced and almost eliminated entirely, I think there were only two cases last year of people born with Down syndrome, because they do an amniocentesis halfway through pregnancy, and any baby in the womb that reveals that genetic code is eliminated. And they think they're doing good. So apart from God, who defines what's good? I'll tell you, people in power. And atheism is a religion of power. Here's another one. Some people say reason, only what the mind and society deem to be reasonable is true. So lately I've heard more and more people say, Mark, what should I say? Someone said to me, belief in God is not logical. How do I respond to that? I said, you need to ask them, what do you mean by that? Because there's nothing illogical about belief in God. Now, if you understand what logic is, logic means that something cannot be both A and not A at the same time in the same place. So if I say God exists and then say God doesn't exist, that's a contradiction. But to say that God exists is not illogical in any way. So we need to push back on people that say, and truthfully, a lot of skeptics will say, it doesn't make sense to me, so it can't be true. When I go out to my car and I stick this little metal thing into a hole and turn it, my car starts up and it drives me down the street. Well, I drive it down the street. That doesn't make sense to me, but that doesn't mean it's not true, right? Astrophysics doesn't make sense to me. For crying out loud, algebra doesn't make sense to me. That doesn't mean it's not true. In other words, that's not a way to judge truth or falsity, whether it makes sense to me. Some people would say philosophy, only what intellectuals and academic institutions believe is true. Oh, let's hope that's not true. My encounter with intellectuals and academic institutions has revealed, in addition to God-given brilliance, even by unbelievers, a whole lot of intellectual fraud, especially when people wander into the area of belief in God and religion. When I did my doctoral work at Villanova, I was in classes with a lot of bright young doctoral students. And after the second semester, I said to the group, we were sitting outside class one day, and they were all in their early 20s, I'm in my early 40s. I said, so do you guys ever discuss truth in these philosophy classes? They're like, nah, we don't care about that. And I said, so then why are you doing a doctorate in philosophy? And there was one in the group that was the brightest guy, and he spoke for everybody. He goes, well, we all just want to land cushy jobs at a university somewhere, drink fine wine, listen to jazz music. And because, honestly, this is what he said, chicks dig philosophy professors. Okay, then. So this is the state of this highly revered discipline of philosophy. In other words, when people say, well, philosophers tell us this, we should shake our heads and ask these questions. Which philosophers? Who said it? Where did you get that from? Because most of that is a big smokescreen. When you examine it, it really doesn't hold. And then finally, some people say, religion is my authority. Sincerity in your belief is all that God, however you conceive him, requires. But as we know, religion can be sincerely wrong. Every time there's a natural disaster or an engineering failure, a plane crash, bridge collapse, people sincerely believe things to be adequate and then they failed when examined. So secondly, then, I want to challenge arguments against the Christian worldview. That is, when people raise an objection, how can you believe in Christianity when? How can there be a God when this? Before I provide an answer, I want to challenge that, push back a little bit. Ask those questions. What do you mean by that? Why do you think this is a problem for Christianity? When people say, science has disproved God, I want to ask, what do you mean by that? But then also, what specifically has science said that makes God impossible? I guarantee you'll rarely encounter someone who can give you a rational answer to that question. They're making it up because science says nothing that disproves God in any way. So what do I want to do? First of all, I want to test the consistency of his worldview. Again, this is why I need to take the time to ask people what they believe, ask all those questions, so I can figure out what they believe, and then I want to see, is this consistent? My favorite one, because it's the most obvious, is scientific naturalism, or what we would call evolution. Evolution teaches that everything that exists came about through a process of blind time and chance. That is, there's no intelligence guiding the universe. Rather, blindly, time and chance, mutations, eventually brought us what we have today. Hubble Space Telescopes and life-saving medicine. And it's just been the slow climb of natural selection, evolutionary process up till now. And they will argue then that something came from nothing. They will argue that intelligence came from non-intelligence and that meaning can come from chance. Now, people who argue that are people who are scientifically minded. In philosophy, no one believes those things at all. So again, sometimes we think science and philosophy are together. They're not. Philosophers would say, you can't demonstrate any of those things. A good one is meaning. You'll have atheists, skeptics, non-believers that say, this world came about through time and chance, but we each need to find our own meaning. That's the equivalent of, everybody remember the game Yahtzee? That little rattly cup with the six or eight dice in it? Saying that we can find meaning in a world that was not designed or no intelligence behind it is like shaking up the dice, rolling them out, and then saying, looks like I should have eggs for breakfast, and I should go to work, and then go to the store and buy an eggplant afterward. If someone ran their life that way, trying to find meaning from random rolls of the dice, we would say, there's some men in white coats here that are going to take you away and help you to find rest and help you with your problems. Hopefully you don't follow your horoscope. That by some random vague writings that someone at a newspaper puts out, you know, let's hope that's all it is, if it's not something more evil beyond that. In other words, if you come across a penny, some people would think, well, I'll have good luck all day, but if someone says, huh, looks like I should invest in pharmaceuticals, you'd say, why are you taking meaning from something random? But in our world today, we're told all the time that you should be able to find meaning even though there's no intelligence in the world. Think about what we do to public school kids. And my son went to public school the last 2 years of his high school career when we moved to Lancaster. It was the best thing for him. He'll tell you that you know, learning to live in a hostile environment and reach unbelievers was a really good thing. But in his school, they would teach him in science class, you came about through blind time and chance. You're nothing but an animal that's evolved. And then they have character traits of the month. So you're an animal, but we want you to have integrity. You came about through blind time and chance, just a meaningless process, and we want you to find meaning in your life. Respect yourself, love yourself. You see the contradiction there? That's why when you ask people their worldview, you're exposing then what they really believe, and then when they talk about things like meaning or justice, as Christians, we should all be for justice. But for someone in a world that came about through evolution, where do you get your idea of justice from? In other words, that makes sense in a Christian worldview. It does not make sense in an unbelieving worldview. Here's another one. Call his bluff. Sometimes people will say, well, don't you know that studies have shown? Oh, studies have shown. Oh, well then, my belief system shattered because studies have shown. In other words, a lot of people bluff. They make up statistics. Don't you know that 99% of scientists are atheists? Like, hopefully we'd recognize that can't be true. And even if it was, that would not disprove Christianity. Call the bluff. Where did you get that from? Show me the study. Send me the study that shows that. And most people will crumble because they often get their ideas, their objections from places like the internet or high school classes. Thirdly, I want to show how the Christian faith... Oh, I want to correct his misconceptions about the Christian faith. Correct his misconceptions about the Christian faith. That is, don't assume people understand the gospel. Don't assume that people understand what Christians really believe. Ask them, so what do you think Christianity is? And you'll hear things like, oh, it's an attempt to be good and, you know, get to God through your own efforts. No, it's not. That's not what it is at all. I had one skeptic say, well, I think people are Christians because they just love rules. I'm like, no, that's not at all the case, because I know I don't love rules in my flesh. That's not how Christianity came about. So we need to correct those misconceptions. We need to show how the Christian faith can answer any legitimate challenge leveled against it. Any legitimate challenge. Now, there are some illegitimate challenges. If I say to Pastor Chan, have you stopped robbing banks yet? If he says yes, what does that imply? He used to rob banks. If he says no, what does that imply? He still is. So, in other words, that's not a legitimate challenge. The old junior high question, can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it, you know? That's not a legitimate challenge against the Christian faith. But anything legitimately raised, how can there be a good God when there's evil and suffering in the world? There are good answers for that. We'll talk about that in the next hour. Fifthly, if you don't know, say so. So important that we as Christians don't bluff and make up statistics and make up rules or make up data or facts or evidence. And truthfully, sometimes when you say, you know, that's a good question, I don't know the answer to that, you make yourself seem more human. And people can appreciate that you're being honest. Because truthfully, you cannot know everything. You can't have an answer for everything. I hear questions all the time that I say, man, that is a good question. I have never thought of that before. I have no idea how to answer that question. But if you would let me go find an answer for you and get back to you. And then thirdly, I want to press the buttons that get to the root of arguments against Christianity. So first of all, buttons of epistemology. How do you know what you know? And we kind of covered that in those questions. Those are all epistemological questions. How do you know what you believe is true? But then also I find very fruitful asking ethical questions. Ethics deals with what is right and wrong and what makes them so. If I meet a skeptic, our conversation almost always comes back to this area. How do you determine right and wrong? Everybody believes in right and wrong, whether they say they do or not. And most people will say, well, yes, I believe in right and wrong. I want to ask the question, what makes something right, what makes something wrong? So for example, notice if you argue for evil, you must also believe in good that stands in contrast to evil. So someone will say, there can't be evil in God in the same world. I say, okay, I'll try to answer that. But first of all, when you say evil, do you believe that there's also good? So that there's two different things in the world, evil and good? Yes, okay. So if there is evil and if there's good, good implies a moral law. That is, what you would call good, there must be some kind of moral law which says this is good for all people at all times. Things like love one another. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. A lot of people are big on the golden rule or some variety of it. So there must be some law which distinguishes that a hug is good, homicide is bad, right? Kissing is good, killing is bad, right? Or do we each decide for ourselves? And most people say, no, killing is always wrong. You know, these things are always wrong and these things are always right. Then I want to say, so you're assuming a moral law, right? That there's something which tells us, and we all ought to know it, and it ought to compel our behavior, right? When you look overseas or even in the United States and you say, this is wrong that's happening over here, you're assuming those people should know it's wrong and shouldn't do it, right? Yes. If there's a moral law, there has to be a moral law giver. That is, this is not like the law of gravity, that we know it because we experience it in the world. If, you know, 99 people jump off the edge of a building and hit the bottom and break their leg and injure, the 100th can't say, now gravity, be nice to me. No, it's going to happen there unless God intervenes. But there has to be a moral law giver. So if you believe in evil, and you believe there can't be a God because there's evil, your question doesn't even make sense because evil assumes a moral lawgiver. Without God, whatever you call evil, it really doesn't exist. It doesn't make sense. You can't distinguish one thing as evil unless there's a God who's given a moral law to distinguish good and evil from one another. Another way I'll often do this is I'll ask people, so how do we know right from wrong? And they tend to start small and they say, well, it's personal. So in the center of your circle there, you can write personal. And this is what they say. We each decide for ourselves. So sitting in a coffee shop, that's where I tend to have my frequent encounters with unbelievers that I don't know. And this guy came and sat down next to me. He was reading a Deepak Chopra book. Anybody know Deepak Chopra, the New Age guru who's on TV? And a lot of times I'll start conversations with people simply by asking them, oh, you know, tell me about your tattoo, or what's that book you're reading, or I noticed the sticker on your computer, what does that mean? It's a great way to start conversations with people you don't know. So I said to the guy, that looks like an interesting book, what is it about? And he said, oh, it's a book about self-actualization. I said, oh, you'll have to explain that to me. He goes, well, we each ought to find the full expression of ourselves and self-fulfillment on our own. I said, okay. So what happens if my self-fulfillment contradicts with yours? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, what if I find self-fulfillment through being aggressive and taking from other people? Would that be okay? He said, well, no. And I said, well, why not? You said we each decide for ourselves. And I said, what if that's my way? He said, well, you shouldn't do it. I said, why not? He said, I said, let's make it more personal. Let's say that while we're sitting here, someone goes to your house, cleans you out, steals everything you own. He started to smell a trap. So he said, well, if that person needed what I had more than I did, I'd be okay with them taking everything. I said, well, you're a better person than I am because I wouldn't be okay with that. I said, well, let's go further. Let's say that they stole not everything you had, but also they stole your identity, ran up your credit cards. Would you be okay with that? And he said, well, he was trying to avoid contradiction. Again, if they needed it more than I did. I said, so you wouldn't call the police? He goes, oh, no, I would call the police. I said, why? Why would you interfere with his self-fulfillment? And he said, you're a Christian, aren't you? And I said, yes. And this is what he said. I don't like to talk about these things with Christians because they don't understand them. I said, okay, no problem. And I left him alone. I went back to doing what I was doing. And I noticed for the next 10 minutes, he was looking at his book and never turned a page. And finally, he closed it and said, you know that thing that you said about, and we went right back into the conversation. Which illustrates the gentleness. If someone says, I don't want to talk about this anymore, we need to respect that, trusting that God can use what we have done so far to work in their hearts. But basically, when you ask people this, and you point out that sometimes personal interests conflict, they'll say, well, society says that's right, that's wrong. Oh, society, okay. Yes, you shouldn't steal things from other people because society says it's wrong. So then I'll often say, so you're saying that Nazi Germany in the 1930s or an area where ISIS has taken over, society agrees that those are the values they ought to have, that's okay? I said, well, no, obviously those are wrong. Wait, why? Well, and then they'll fall back one more level. Common sense tells us those societies were wrong. They were messed up. Oh, so it's common sense which really determines right from wrong. They started with personal, that failed. They went to society, that couldn't support the weight of right and wrong. So now common sense. And I'll often say, don't you know, people all around the world have different ideas of what common sense is. You know, where I come from in New England, if you live right next to a farm, they don't spray it with liquid manure on a warm day. But apparently in this part of the country, that's perfectly okay. No, the truth is, you go around the world, everyone has a different idea of common sense, so that can't answer. And I point out the fact that what they're looking for is something transcendent. And this is where you get to the heart of the unbeliever, who often will put up all these objections when the real issue is their own heart. I say, I think what you're looking for, and I'm really glad to see that you're bothered by sin in the world, by evil, by brokenness. But according to your standard, there's no way to condemn someone else from doing something wrong. You're looking for something outside of us who has declared this is wrong, this is right. I said, you're trying to find God. And in your worldview, you can't declare anything right and wrong, even though intuitively you know it is. In the Christian worldview, we can say this is wrong, and here's why. Because it reflects the character of God, and it reflects the commandments of God. And as a Christian, I know it's right and wrong because God has shared his character of truth and holiness and purity and beauty and justice and wrath and mercy and grace. And then he's given us commandments of how we ought to live. Therefore, I have an objective standard by which to judge right and wrong. I can condemn injustice. I can condemn cruelty, the things that bother you. But in your worldview, you can't condemn those things even though intuitively you know they're wrong. And that undoes some people. People come to realize, wow, my worldview cannot justify what I believe to be right and wrong, but the Christian worldview does, and it shakes them, it shatters them. And that is powerful. And at that point, then, we begin to present the gospel clearly. Because now their stronghold is down. And then they see the glory and beauty of the Christian gospel that makes sense of everything in our experience. And that is how we answer the objections that are raised against the Christian faith. So Ryan is going to come now. He's going to play the part of an unbeliever. We're going to stand around a music stand. I don't know what he says. I mean, I don't know what he's about to say. So what I'm going to do is try to show you, here are some ways I would respond if someone were to say these things to me, and give you an idea of how to put into practice some of what we've covered. So I want you to watch what I do, observe the things I say or the questions I ask, and then we'll take some questions when it's over. Okay. So I think, what are we doing here?
Is the mic on? Yep, it's on. Yeah. Okay,
Sure. So we'll pretend we're in a coffee shop and it's crowded, so we're sharing a stand-up cafe table, something like that. So, how you doing today?
Good, how you doing?
Good. Taking a break from work?
Yeah, just trying to work on my new TED Talk that I'm going to give.
Giving a TED Talk?
Yeah. I've been
dressed
working
like
on it
that?
For a while. Yeah, dressed like this, yep. You're not too shabby yourself.
Yeah, well, I try to look nice in society, but you know.
Yeah, well, I don't
know. So, what are you giving a TED Talk on?
Well, I'm just giving a TED Talk on how we can use science to teach us how to be better people, and how we don't need religion anymore, but science is almost the new era for people and can teach us how to work as a society.
Wow, that's really interesting. Now, when you say that we don't need religion to be good anymore, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that, you know, in the olden times before, you know, when people couldn't really play nice with one another, you know, they had to establish religion to kind of teach them, hey, here's what we can and what we can't do so we're not hitting each other over the head with rocks all the time. But now that science has taken over, we know what is good just based off of how helpful it is to us in our evolutionary process.
Wow.
So whatever helps us grow and develop as people is what's good. And so we can kind of leave all those arbitrary religious rules behind.
Okay. Wow, that's really interesting. I've never heard anybody talk about science that way. How specifically does science help us determine right from wrong?
Well, you know, it tells us what we need. And it gets rid of all the, you know, all the different rules that don't really have anything to do. It tells us, okay, what do we need to survive and what do we need to thrive? So, you know, for instance, we know we need food, water, and those things to survive. But what do we need to thrive? We need, you know, opportunities. We need people to work together. We need people to be able to love one another. You know, all those things. We need those things to help us get along so that we can all develop and help each other out as a society. So those are the kinds of things that would help us out. And it gets rid of all those, you know, all the dead weight rules that don't really matter.
Interesting. So I assume that you believe in evolution and that's the process that guides life.
Mm-hmm.
So at what point did evolution move from helping us survive to thrive? I was always taught evolution, natural selection, was all about learning to help the organism survive. But you're talking about thriving. What do you mean by thriving?
Well, I mean, I think now that you and I have all these people around us, all these resources, we don't have to suffer trying to hunt and to gather for our food. We have we can go to the grocery store, so we don't have to spend all that time doing that. So we have time where we can just develop ourselves as people and become better people. So now we're in the thrive stage where we're not always having to rush around and, you know, we're not always starving to death. We can, you know, have everything that we need within close reach, which allows us to move forward to a better civilization.
Okay. And when you say better civilization, what would that look like to you?
You know, I think something where everybody just wants what's best for the other person.
Hmm. And how does science specifically determine what's best for every person?
Well, I think just what's going to help this person grow as, you know, as a person. Is it going to help pull them out of a bad situation, whether that be poverty, whether that be, you know, sickness, or is it going to put them in that situation? You know, for instance, things like racism, you know, we would say would be bad because that puts people down.
Okay.
You know, and so, you know, other things lift people up. So.
Hmm. Now, if I understand natural selection right, the weak die, the strong survive, right?
Yeah.
So, it following your worldview, why do we want to help the weak survive? I mean, doesn't that hinder evolution?
Well, we have to be, I mean, yeah, but I think everybody would generally know that, you know, we don't have to be that way. I mean, I think we all feel a sense of we need to be nice and kind to the person next to us because we would want somebody to be kind to us.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm a Christian, so...
Oh, nice.
Now why do you react that way?
Well, it's because every time that, you know, I talk about this, Christians always get all puffed up and hot-headed because, you know, well, you know, you're just going to take us down this road and we're going to have to give up our traditions and our buildings and our money and, you know, and that's all churches are, it's just money. That's what it's all comes down to. So I just kind of get frustrated, you know, when I talk to people about this because it just, you know, people get so insecure about where religion's going to head.
Wow. So what is your religious background? Did you grow up in a church of any kind?
Well, you know, I had some experiences, you know, growing up. My mom was a Christian and, you know, she went to church and, you know, the church that she was at, you know, the pastor was very demanding and they came to my mother and they said, you need to give more to the church. And my mother had nothing.
Mm.
You know, we were living on basically nothing and, you know, and she wouldn't give more. They eventually kicked her out. And so, you know, my whole life, you know, if that's what religion is, and I want no part in it.
Yeah, I can understand your reluctance and or your desire not to want to have anything to do with it because that's not Christianity. I mean, that may have been a church that did that kind of thing, but that has nothing to do with what Christianity is really about. And that's tragic that your mom was treated that poorly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. But let's go back to the question of evolution or science helping us be that way. Who gets to decide, you know, what leads to society getting better? I mean, because people have different views about that. Some believe we ought to have, you know, Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher, said we ought to have a society that's aggressive and cruel, and some people believe that's the kind of world we ought to have. You sound like you're arguing for a gentle world or a kinder world.
Well, you know, I think that philosophers just have their head up in the clouds a little too much, and, you know, that's where you get crazy theories like that. But I think that scientists –